These great townships subsisted on the enormous cereal wealth of Mesopotamia, watered as it then was by canals, whose makers' names were even then already lost in the mists of antiquity. Babylon and Nineveh had passed away. The successors of Persia and Macedon had given place to Parthia, but the people and the cultivation were the same as when Cyrus the Conqueror had first subdued the land. The language of many of the towns was Greek, and the cultured citizens of Seleucia might criticize the philosophies and tragedies of Athens, but the millions of the agricultural population knew possibly no more of these things than does many an Essex peasant of today know of what passes in the metropolis. Compare with this the state of affairs at the end of the 7th century. Syria was now an impoverished and stricken land, and her great cities, though still populated, must have been encumbered with ruins, which the public funds were not sufficient to remove. Damascus and Jerusalem themselves hadn't recovered from the effects of long and terrible sieges. Amman and Gerash had declined into wretched villages under the sway and lordship of the Bedouin. The Horan, perhaps, still showed signs of the prosperity for which it had been noted in the days of Trajan, but the wretched buildings and rude inscriptions of this date all point to a sad and depressing decline. Out in the desert, Palmyra stood empty and desolate, save for a garrison in the castle. On the coasts and in the Lebanon, a shadow of the former business and wealth was still to be seen, but in the north, ruin, desolation and abandonment must have been the common state of the country, which had been raided with unfailing regularity for 100 years and had been held by an enemy for 15. Agriculture must have declined, and the population notably decreased through the plagues and distresses from which it had suffered. Cappadocia had insensibly sunk into barbarism, and the great basilicas and cities, which the rude countrymen could neither repair nor restore, had been levelled with the ground. The Anatolian peninsula had been ploughed and harrowed by the Persian armies. The great cities had been plundered and sacked. Fourth, it was while Heraclius was engaged in restoring order in this already desolated Syria, after the death of Chosroes II and before the final peace with Persia, that a strange message was brought to him. The bearer had ridden over to the imperial outpost at Bostra, in the wilderness south of Damascus. The letter was in Arabic, the obscure Semitic language of the nomadic peoples of the southern desert, and probably only an interpretation reached him, presumably with deprecatory notes by the interpreter. It was an odd, florid challenge from someone who called himself Mohammed, the prophet of God. This Mohammed, it appeared, called upon Heraclius to acknowledge the one true God and to serve him. Nothing else was definite in the document. There's no record of the reception of this missive, and presumably it went unanswered. The emperor probably shrugged his shoulders and was faintly amused at the incident. But at Ctesiphon they knew more about this Mohammed. He was said to be a tiresome false prophet who had incited Yemen, the rich province of southern Arabia, to rebel against the King of Kings. Kavadi was much occupied with affairs. He had deposed and murdered his father, Chosroes II, and he was attempting to reorganize the Persian military forces. To him also came a message, identical with that sent to Heraclius. The thing angered them. He tore up the letter, flung the fragments at the envoy, and bade him begone. When this was told to the sender, far away in the squalid little town of Medina, he was very angry. "Even so, O Lord," he cried, "rend thou his kingdom from him." AD 628. Fifth. But before we go on to tell of the rise of Islam in the world, it'll be well to complete our survey of the condition of Asia in the dawn of the 7th century. And a word or so is due to religious developments in the Persian community during the Sassanid period. From the days of Cyrus onward, Zoroastrianism had prevailed over the ancient gods of Nineveh and Babylon. Zoroaster, the Greek spelling of the Iranian Zarathustra, like Buddha, was an Aryan. We know nothing of the age in which he lived. Some authorities make him as early as 1000 BC. Others make him contemporary with Buddha or Confucius. And as little do we know of his place of birth or his exact nationality. His teachings are preserved to us in the Zend Avesta. But here, since they no longer play any great part in the world's affairs, we can't deal with them in any detail. The opposition of a good god, Ormuzd, the god of light, truth, frankness, and the sun, and a bad god, Ahriman, god of secrecy, cunning, diplomacy, darkness, and night, formed a very central part of his religion. As we find it in history, it's already surrounded by a ceremonial and sacerdotal system. It has no images, but it has priests, temples and altars on which burn a sacred fire and at which sacrificial ceremonies are performed. Among other distinctive features is its prohibition of either the burning or the burial of the dead. The Parsis of India, the last surviving Zoroastrianism, still lay their dead out within certain open towers, the towers of silence, to which the vultures come. Under the Sassanid kings, from Ardashir onward, in 227, this religion was the official religion. Its head was the second person in the state next to the king, and the king, in quite the ancient fashion, was supposed to be divine or semi-divine, and upon terms of peculiar intimacy with Ormuzd. But the religious fermentation of the world didn't leave the supremacy of Zoroastrianism undisputed in the Persian Empire. Not only was there a great eastward diffusion of Christianity, to which we've already given notice, but new sects arose in Persia, incorporating the novel ideas of the time. One early variant or branch of Zoroastrianism, Mithraism, we've already named. It had spread into Europe by the 1st century BC, after the eastern campaigns of Pompey the Great. It became enormously popular with the soldiers and common people, and until the time of Constantine the Great continued to be a serious rival to Christianity. Indeed, one of his successors, the Emperor Julian, 361 to 363, known in Christian history as Julian the Apostate, made a belated attempt to substitute it for the accepted faith. Mithras was a god of light, proceeding from Ormuzd and miraculously born, in much the same way that the third person in the Christian Trinity proceeds from the first. Of this branch of the Zoroastrian stem, we need say no more. In the 3rd century AD, however, another religion, Manichaeism, arose, which deserves some notice now. Mani, the founder of Manichaeism, was born the son of a good family of Ecbatana, the old Median capital, in AD 216. He was educated at Ctesiphon. His father was some sort of religious sectary, and he was brought up in an atmosphere of religious discussion. There came to him that persuasion that he at last had the complete light, which is the moving power of all religious initiators. He was impelled to proclaim his doctrine. In AD 242, at the accession of Sarpor I, the second Sassanid monarch, he began his teaching. It's characteristic of the way in which men's minds were moving in those days that his teaching included a sort of theocrasia. He wasn't, he declared, proclaiming anything new. The great religious founders before him had all been right. Moses, Zoroaster, Buddha, Jesus Christ, all had been true prophets, but to him it was appointed to clarify and crown their imperfect and confused teaching. This he did in Zoroastrian language. He explains the perplexities and contradictions of life as a conflict of light and darkness. Ormuzd was God, and Ahriman, Satan. But how man was created, how he fell from light into darkness, how he's being disentangled and redeemed from the darkness, and of the part played by Jesus in this strange mixture of religions, we can't explain here, even if we would. Our interest with the system is historical and not theological.